You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. Dr. Matthew Walker is the author of a popular book called Why We Sleep. It has a singular goal: to reunite humanity with one of the most important things that we do whilst on this planet, sleep. The book provides a complete description of and prescription for sleep. It answers critical questions about sleep. How do caffeine and alcohol affect sleep? What really happens during dreaming? Why do sleep patterns change across a lifetime? And how do common sleep pills affect us, and can they do long-term damage? Delighted to be joining me live on the line, author of Why We Sleep, Dr. Matthew Walker. Dr. Walker, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It seems like one of the easiest things that we possibly do, sleep, but it's so much more complicated than that, and it has such a huge effect on our mental health, our physical health. What inspired you to write the book?
Well, I think it was really the perfect storm in terms of timing. We knew that there was a decimation of sleep that was happening throughout the developed world. And this sort of global sleep loss epidemic was coming with terrible health consequences. The evidence seemed to be clear that just about every disease that's killing us in first world nations, from Alzheimer's to cancer, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, stroke, even suicide most recently, has been linked to a lack of sleep. So there was a real, I think, public health service requirement for the science of sleep to be communicated to the public and the dangers of not getting enough. And the fact that we weren't getting enough because sleep time has diminished over the past 100 years, but also the fact that sleep science has actually now matured. We've learned so much in the past 50 years. And we used to ask, what is sleep good for? Why do we sleep? And the answer is, now there is no tissue or organ within your body, and there's no process within your brain that isn't enhanced by sleep when you get it or impaired when you don't. So it was the blossoming of the science combined with the fact that we're in this sleep loss epidemic catastrophe that really I felt as though it was time to give a book to the public and see if I could help inflect change, because change must happen.
The sleep loss epidemic calamity, perhaps it's because in the past 100 years the way that we live has changed so dramatically. If you think back previous to that, obviously people got up with the sun, they worked during the sun hours, and when night came, they slept. They would get, if you like, their 8 hours a day or whatever. Perhaps in a modern 24/7 multi-technology world, this is no longer possible.
You're so true, so right. You know, if you look at surveys back in the 1940s, the average adult was sleeping about 7.9 hours. Now that number is about 6 hours and 40 minutes, which is a remarkable loss of sleep within just 70 years, considering the fact that it took Mother Nature 3.6 million years to put this necessity of 8 hours of sleep in place. And we've come along within the space of 100 years, and we've taken away 20% of that. How could health consequences not emerge as a result? What is causing that, I think, is a really interesting question. We know, for example, that the invasion of technology in the bedroom is a problem. Blue light devices, screens, tablets, checking of phone, those are concerns. But it's more than that. We know that there are longer commute times right now, so people leave the house earlier and they come home later. Working hours have actually increased as well. And we're also seeing record rates of anxiety. So people psychologically are struggling with the life in this world that we call modernity. And that has a major impact. It seems to be perhaps one of the principal causes of insomnia is a psychological cause rather than necessarily a biological cause. So I think all of these factors, together with the use, or perhaps I should say abuse, of caffeine and alcohol in the later day in the evening, all of these things conspire to have us sleeping less.
The other thing, of course, is social pressure. I mean, again, as I said before, in a modern world where we're supposed to be on the ball 24/7, it's a case of, well, I only survive on 6 hours sleep. I mean, I get various bits and pieces sent to me on the internet, and I try not to read it because of the blue lights last thing at night, but they're saying, you know, you can survive on 6 hours sleep, and then you can get up and you could be doing your hustle and the whole, and getting out there and getting the business in and surviving in this modern world. Perhaps getting the sleep has been looked upon as laziness or sloth, when it, in fact it is a vital part of recharging and rebuilding the various cells and systems that go up to make ourselves up.
Well, I think this is incredibly insightful, because this is another problem that we have stigmatized getting sufficient sleep with, that label of laziness, as you mentioned. And, you know, people will say, well, I get 8 hours, and you kind of think, well, they're a bit of a sloth. What are they doing? And I think part of the problem is that everyone in society in a way wants to seem busy, because busy seems to equal importance. And one way that you can show you're busy and therefore important is to almost, you know, brag about how little sleep that you're getting. And some people do this, and some people almost wear it like a badge of honor on the, you know, sleeve. And it is a problem, because I think it tries to belittle people who are prioritizing their sleep. And I should note, by the way, that idea of getting up and being busy and being efficient and getting lots done goes against the idea of getting too little sleep, because we know that less sleep does not equal more productivity. That evidence is very clear in the workplace, that underslept employees, they select fewer work problems, they produce fewer creative solutions, they ride the coattails of other people's work, they slack off when they're working in other groups, they're more devious at work, they lie and they cheat more often if they're underslept, and business leaders too. From one day to the next, the more or less sleep that a business leader has had, the more or less charismatic they appear to their employees, even though their employees know nothing about their sleep. So I think business has this entrenched mentality about the uselessness of sleep, and that needs to change too in terms of that stigma. So you're absolutely right that sleep has an image problem in society, and that needs to be rectified as well.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because we live also in a body-conscious world. We're talking about the look that we give on society, and we're always told we need to be looking better and looking sharper and looking fitter. But if you train to any sort of decent level, we're always being told, eat properly, sleep properly, rest, relax, let those cells rebuild themselves. And not only physically, but you mentioned insomnia, you mentioned anxiety, and you mentioned depression. And these are all systems of irregular sleeping patterns.
They are. Every single psychiatric disease that we've studied demonstrates some kind of sleep abnormality. We can't find a single psychiatric condition, in fact, in which sleep is normal. And I think psychiatry now is starting to really understand that sleep disruption is not just a consequence of psychiatric issues, but it may actually be contributing a causal influence that maybe even instigates some of these disorders. And there's actually now quite good evidence for that too. So that mental health aspect of sleep is fast becoming prominent. And getting sufficient sleep at night essentially is emotional first aid. It's overnight therapy.
It sounds like what we need, and we've had education in what we eat, how we exercise, our drinking habits, we're all told we must hydrate. It sounds as if we need a plan being set out for us and some more education when it comes to our downtime and our dream time. Is that what you're trying to do with the book, Why We Sleep?
That's exactly what the last couple of chapters really try to do, which is to say, this is how bad things have become, and these are all of the diseases and the sickness that occurs by way of a lack of sleep. But I don't think people respond if all you do is wag the finger and tell them about the bad story. You have to give them some kind of a future answer, and that's what the final chapters do. It's a prescription for the future, and I think the change in sleep has to happen at all levels. It has to start at the government level. You know, when was the last time that you heard any first world nation have a public health campaign regarding sleep?
Absolutely not at all. I mean, Margaret Thatcher used to boast that she could survive on 4 hours of sleep, if you remember correctly.
She did, and same with Ronald Reagan. And it's not coincidental that insufficient sleep is now one of the most significant lifestyle factors determining whether or not you'll develop Alzheimer's. And tragically, both of them went on to develop Alzheimer's. Now, I'm not going to make too much of that because it's just two people, but it has to start at the government level. And we need public health campaigns just like we do regarding the dangers of smoking or drugs. Where is the campaign for sleep? And we need that. We need it in education. When I was at school, I got lessons about sort of you know, risky behaviors and, you know, drug taking. No one told me about sleep. We need an educational module in schools regarding sleep. We need it in the healthcare system. You know, when was the last time a doctor prescribed a good night of sleep to you? And we're not talking sleeping pills here. You know, it, and the reason is because doctors themselves get all next to no education about sleep when they go to medical school. That needs to change. We need to change in the family, because I think parents actually provide this parent-to-child transmission of sleep neglect. You know, teenagers have the duvet covers pulled off them at weekends, and parents are saying, you know, wake up, you're wasting the day. Well, firstly, they sleep late because that's how they are biologically wired at that time. It's not their fault. It's what happens during adolescence. And also, they're trying to sleep off a debt that we've saddled them with these incessant early school start times. So we need to change sleep in the home, within the family setting, and then finally down at the individual themselves. So it has to happen at all of these different scaled levels. That's how we can change, I think.
You mentioned sleeping pills, and we can also talk about alcohol and caffeine in here, but you know, so sleeping pill presumably is what we would call a short-term fix to a long-term problem.
It is, and medicine right now, if it's practiced properly, should only be prescribing sleeping pills for a very short-term period. However, we know that sleeping pills have a higher risk associated with them of death and cancer, and that information is not, I think, adequately being communicated to the public. And it's a chapter in the book that is very detailed. I describe that science. And what I wanted to do there, I'm not anti-medication, and if medications work, I'm all for them. It's just that the current sleeping medications that we have right now do not produce naturalistic sleep. They are called the sedative hypnotics, and sedation is not sleep. So you're simply knocking the brain out. You're not putting it into natural sleep. So I do want to caution people about the risks associated with sleeping pills, give them the information, and then together with their doctor, they can, armed with that science, make an informed choice about whether or not they actually do wish to take sleeping pills, because they're not informed by that information right now.
And also the other thing is, we're talking about alcohol here. I mean, this attacks, you could get a good 8 hours sleep if you've had a lot to drink, but it's the quality of the sleep, not the quantity of the sleep in this case.
Yeah, if you've had a lot to drink, what you'll get is 8 hours of sedation and non-consciousness, but you won't get 8 hours of sleep because, again, alcohol is also in the class of drugs that we call the sedatives. So alcohol also has two additional problems with sleep. Firstly, it will actually fragment your sleep, so you wake up many more times throughout the night. They tend to be so brief that you don't commit them to memory, but you wake up feeling unrefreshed. And the final problem with alcohol is that it blocks your dream sleep, your rapid eye movement sleep, which is essential for numerous aspects of your brain function. So alcohol should be avoided. I'm deeply unpopular. No one likes me when I tell them all, you know, stop drinking caffeine after, you know, 2 p.m. and don't take the nightcap. I'm sure I'm the most boring scientist in the world in this regard. But caffeine as well is a problem. And some people will say, I'm one of those who can have an espresso after dinner and I fall asleep fine, I stay asleep. That may be true. The problem is that the depth of the deep sleep that you get when caffeine is swilling around within the brain is not as deep as if you were just having natural deep sleep. So you will wake up the next morning, you'll think, well, I feel unrefreshed, but I didn't have problems falling asleep and I didn't wake up throughout the night, so it wasn't the caffeine. But then you have to have 2 cups of coffee in the morning rather than one, and you create this dependency, you create this vicious cycle, this escalation of caffeine use. And I should note, by the way, caffeine is the second most traded commodity on the surface of this planet after oil, which I think says everything to do with our current state of sleep deprivation.
You mentioned here the dreaming, and people have written tomes about what happens when we dream and the you know, the images within and what they actually mean. But there is a scientific basis for rapid eye movement sleep and how it refreshes the brain as well.
There is, and that Freudian doctrine, I think, has long been let go of by science. Freud is not a scientifically valid or provable theory, and so it's no longer embraced by science. That's not to say dreams don't have some kind of function. They do. And we know of at least two benefits currently. The first we've spoken about, which is that dream sleep actually takes difficult emotional experiences or even trauma that you've been having during the day. And it's almost like a nocturnal soothing balm, that it just takes the sharp edges and the painful sting out of those emotional experiences so that you wake up the next day feeling better about them. So it's, I suppose it's not time that heals all wounds. It's time during dream sleep that actually provides that emotional convalescence, as it were. So we also know that dreaming provides remarkable benefits for memory. And dream sleep actually collides recent things that you've learned with all of your back catalog of stored information. So you start to build new connections and you start to seek out novel insights. You're essentially updating your mind-wide web of associations of information. And that's the reason that people wake up with these remarkable problem-solving resolutions by way of sleep. Lots of great data on this. And it's the reason that no one has ever told you that you should stay awake on a problem.
So what are we going to do then? How are we going to ensure better sleep and more restful sleep and better quality sleep than in our daily lives and our daily nights?
It is so difficult. And I think, you know, the first thing people have to do is prioritize their sleep. You have to be carving out that non-negotiable 8-hour opportunity every night. Thereafter, I think there are probably five short tips that people can hold on to for better sleep. The first is regularity. Make sure that you go to bed at the same time and wake up at the same time, no matter whether it's the work week or the weekend. It's a mistake that people make. Keep it regular. The second is keep your bedroom cool, if you can, somewhere around about 18.5 degrees Celsius or about sort of 67, 68 degrees Fahrenheit is optimal. The reason is because your body needs to drop its temperature to get to sleep. So you can help it do that by keeping your room cool. The next is darkness. We are a dark-deprived society. So power down the laptops and the computers in the last hour before bed. Also, dim the lights. You don't need all of the lights on in the last hour in the house. Switch half of them off, and that will help too. Next, don't stay in bed awake if you're having problems, because your brain will start to learn that your bed is about being awake rather than about being asleep. So the advice is, if you're awake for a while in bed and you can't fall asleep, don't stay there. Go to a different room with dim light, read a book, and only when you're sleepy should you return to bed. And that way your brain relearns the association that your bed is about sleep. If you don't feel comfortable, by the way, with getting out of bed because you'd like to stay in bed, you can also try meditating. The scientific studies, clinical studies with meditation have demonstrated that it can really help relax the brain and relax the nervous system when you're awake at night and quiet those spinning wheels of the mind. The final thing is, unfortunately, alcohol and caffeine, which we've spoken about. Try to have your last caffeinated drink at around 2 p.m., and sadly, forego the nightcap. The advice I would never give on talk radio would be that you should go to the pub in the morning, and that way the alcohol is out of your system by the evening. But I would never do that because it would be deeply politically incorrect for me to say, so I won't say it.
And as we are based in Spain and being Spain's largest English language broadcaster, what are your thoughts just quickly on one of our traditions, the siesta?
Well, there's good argument to suggest that that's how we were designed to sleep, because if you look at hunter-gatherer tribes whose way of life has not changed for thousands of years, they haven't been touched by modernity or the industrial revolution, they sleep in that biphasic pattern. In other words, they have about 6.5 hours at night and they have a sort of an afternoon nap, a siesta-like nap. And in fact, we are all genetically hardwired to do this because we all have a pre-programmed drop in our alertness somewhere between about 1 to 4 p.m. So it seems as though Mother Nature actually designed us to sleep in these two shifts. I would say, by the way, however, that if you're struggling with sleep at night, it's best not to nap because the nap will take away some of that healthy sleepiness that you've been building up during the day and will make it that much more difficult for you to fall asleep at night. So for those who can nap regularly and don't have problems with sleep at night, naps are just fine.
The book is called Why We Sleep. If people want to find out about what you do, Dr. Walker, and some little more information and learn some more tips, I know you do the website and the social media thing. Where can they find you?
They can find me at Sleep Diplomat on all channels. So that's sleepdiplomat.com for my website, or they can find me on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. I'm there at Sleep Diplomat as well.
Super. Dr. Walker, I've only got to ask, what's next in, what are you up to next? What's the next subject of your research into the world of sleep, into the world of our dreams?
Well, we're doing a lot of work with sleep and aging and Alzheimer's disease. We're trying to develop electrical brain stimulation methods to try and restore sleep in the elderly and see if we can fight back the onslaught of aging and Alzheimer's disease. That's one of our big projects coming up right now.
Fascinating. Thank you for your time today, Dr. Matthew Walker. Have a great and restful day.
Thanks very much. Sleep well.